Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
Late last year, the entire world was simply holding its breath, praying that vaccines against COVID-19 would work. And they did. As soon as approval was reached, countries like Canada, who were lucky enough to have access to supply, got moving quickly. In this country, we began with people over the age of 80, and we worked our way down from there. In the late spring, vaccine appointments became available for anyone ages 12 and up. And since then, nothing further.
Drug makers insist vaccines for kids will be thoroughly tested, but it's almost certain they'll be going back to school next September without a vaccine.
If you are not a parent of a child under 12 and you don't know any, I will fill you in. School is starting. Their kids are not vaccinated, and most of the parents are terrified. Why haven't vaccines been approved for kids under 12 yet? And what is a realistic timeline for, first, getting shots into younger kids, but then a timeline for toddlers or infants? And while we have an expert here, how has the full FDA approval of the Pfizer vaccine impacted vaccine hesitancy? Have mandates and passports helped with that? And if we're being honest, can anything help with this at this point? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Sabina Vora Miller is a clinical pharmacologist who has spent, I guess, more than a year now working on vaccine education, combating vaccine hesitancy, and just living in this world, right?
Hi, yes, that's exactly it.
So the first thing I want to hit you with is just, we've heard, I think, for a while now that we're close to approval for a vaccine for under 12. Where is that at? And is there an actual timeline we can discuss here?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the reason is because there have been a bit of a, it's been a bit of a moving target. So originally, the way these pediatric trials are designed, you know, they're meant to be stepwise in a stepwise fashion. So, you know, you start with the 12 to 17, which we have data for and it's approved. Then you go into the age group, below that. So that's 5 to 11. And then it would be 2 to 5. And then it would be 6 months to 2 years. And with each of this, there's also a dose de-escalation. So there's a different dose for, you know, the 5 to 11 range. And there's another dose, a lower dose for the 6 months to the 5 range. And so, you know, all of these, they're done in a very stepwise fashion for a reason, because we want to make sure that the vaccine, the dose that the children are getting is actually the right dose for them. So it's not, you know, too low and it's not too high at the same time. So what happened is that originally, with the way the trials were designed, we had anticipated we would have data available, in fact, you know, by August. However, the FDA has had requested the manufacturers to go back and actually increase the trial size. So, you know, with the concerns that we've been seeing with the myocarditis, which is essentially that inflammation of the heart muscle, generally occurs due to an immune-mediated reason, and we see more of this occurring in younger versus older people. And so we wanted to make sure that there was absolutely no concerns with the myocarditis in these younger age groups. And if there is, then we wanted to know, you know, what's the incidence of this occurring, you know, whether they're mild for the most part or not, and just get more details on this adverse event in the pediatric population. And so because of that, the FDA basically said to the drug manufacturers that we want you to increase the trial size, so the number of people who were enrolled in these pediatric trials. And so you know, they did that. And because of that, the timelines have now shifted. What then happened subsequently is that the FDA is now also asking for more than 2 months of safety data. So typically for vaccines, we collect 2 months of data. And that's because within 8 weeks, we have a really good idea what the side effects are going to look like, given that majority of the side effects are immune related. Right. And by 8 weeks, you know, everything has sort of simmered down and, you know, your body's kind of gone back into pre-vaccine mode in terms of the immune response. And so we have a really good understanding of what things are at the 2 month mark. The FDA, however, has come back and said that perhaps they might actually want 6 months of safety data. This is actually a point of contention because the American Academy of Pediatricians, which is a large body of, you know, the consensus farming pediatricians in the U.S., you know, wrote a letter, submitted it to the FDA saying that 6 months is not necessary for vaccines. We have a good idea given of how many doses we've given of these vaccines across the world, you know, and children are being impacted by Delta. It's so timely for them, given that they're going to school, that we should have these vaccines available sooner rather than later. Of course, due diligence is important. And so that's the point that we actually don't have much clarity, because what we don't know is whether, because the FDA has requested this information, whether the drug manufacturers would actually provide interim data. So would they provide data with the original sample size? The manufacturer so far said no. Will they provide data with the 2 month safety? We don't know that. They haven't actually made any, they haven't really said anything on that front. So there's a bit of a question mark in some of these timelines, but the last that we've heard so far is that we should have data available by end of September, which means that we would have approval likely by end of November. And I think that is really the timeline we're looking at here in Canada, because again, the Canada does not have to follow FDA stipulations. We can essentially, you know, have our own requirements that the Health Canada has for pediatric approvals. So 5 to 11, we're expecting it, you know, data to be available by end of September, approval by approximately end of November. Following that, we will see approval in the age range just underneath, so 2 to 5. And then following that, so sometime perhaps first quarter of next year is when we're going to see approvals for the 6 month to 2. But that, of course, is, you know, as long as everything goes according to plan.
That all seems very chaotic, but just to clear it up and put it plainly for parents, the current hope then is 5 to 12 by end of the year, hopefully by Christmas time.
Yes.
2 to 5s by perhaps early next year, and then end of winter, early spring for infants. Is that about right?
Yeah, that sounds about right. That's, of course, you know, if everything goes according to plan, we don't ask for 6 months of safety data, and we actually have these trials completed in time as well.
I'm also going to ask it because I'm sure people are worrying about it right now. You kind of casually mentioned it a couple times. Is there a risk that if the FDA insists on 6 months of data, that knocks everything back that we just discussed by another 4 months?
There's always that potential. I think that for us in Canada, that's the place where we may have more leeway. We can, in fact, ask for the manufacturer to submit with the 2 month data, and we can, in fact, make a decision using that 2 month data. So, you know, I think that a lot of this is still up in the air. Health Canada has not come out and said anything, either that they're supportive of the 6 months or that they're okay with the 2 months. So some of that is still up in the air, but we don't have to follow FDA's regulations. And that is where we will have some leeway in terms of having a potentially earlier approval than in the US, which we actually did see with the 12 to 17 age group. Canada actually approved the vaccines before the US did.
One of the other questions, and you mentioned it very briefly, is what do we know now that we didn't know yet in the spring about the inflamed heart condition, the myocarditis?
Yeah, and so with the myocarditis, you know, I think that first of all, myocarditis is just something that We don't really understand what the actual even baseline risk is, because a lot of times it can occur subclinically, so without any actual clinical symptoms. So we have seen some instances of this occurring. What we see it happening is generally it happens with younger people and usually after dose two, and more often in men versus in women. We don't actually have a really good idea what the incidence is with respect to the vaccines. There are a couple of different rates that are being, currently thrown out, but we don't have a good idea of what the actual incidence is with the vaccines. But what we do know is that when they do occur with the vaccines, they are far milder than when they actually occur after COVID infection. So that's the key part, in that COVID infections themselves have a risk of myocarditis. And usually with COVID infections, risks of myocarditis are much more severe with COVID infections. What we see with the vaccines is generally a milder version of it. And for the most part, treated, easily either in the hospital or at home with supportive care. But we're still trying to understand what the actual core incidence is in Canada as well as across the world.
In terms of vaccine rates and what we need to get to in order to achieve herd immunity and hopefully get out of this thing, I wanted to ask you about the full FDA approval of the Pfizer vaccine and what it means to people who have been on the fence. I know you're someone that talks daily to a lot of people in real time who are trying to decide whether or not to get the vaccine or not. And has this made an impact?
Yeah, great question. I do personally, I feel that those who actually use that as a reason to not get vaccinated are generally the kind of people that you may not necessarily be able to reason with logic. So I personally don't actually think that this full FDA approval is going to move the needle very much in those who are not vaccinated because of that. I think that with the full approval, it's really is a process technicality. It's similar, here in Canada, we use the interim order pathway to approve COVID-19 related drugs or vaccines. It's a temporary pathway that has been created to make sure that we're doing more efficient and quicker reviews, such as, making rolling reviews possible. So it just makes it a lot more timely, which is necessary in the time of a pandemic. But in both the EUA as well as the emergency use authorization in the US, as well as the interim order pathway that we're using in Canada, due diligence is still the same, is exactly the same, in that, there is the requirement of robust data for both efficacy as well as for safety. There is still surveillance post-market of the products that are approved. All of that still occurs. And so if anyone's actually using this as a reason to not get vaccinated, I don't think that the full approval is actually going to move the needle, so to speak, with them. I think that might just be an avenue for a change in goalpost. But of course, I am happy to be proven wrong on that.
In terms of the people who haven't been vaccinated yet, and, now looking at general data, I'm not going to pick it apart, but, we're up in the high 70s in some places. When we spoke about vaccine hesitancy back in the spring, we talked about a lot of people who you were speaking to and other people were trying to convince who were on the fence, who had concerns, or there were accessibility issues. And when we spoke back then, there was a belief that the actual hardcore anti-vaxxers who would never get vaccinated, the really loud ones, were actually a very small percentage. And now that it's been available to everyone who is eligible for months now, how many of those people are left, and how much more convincing can we do? Or are we getting to the point where we've hit that line and everybody left is just unwilling?
Yeah, I think there is still room for reaching people that have not yet been vaccinated. And I can say that personally from the work that I've been doing. In the last couple of weeks, I've already I've spoken to several that have changed their mind. There was one person who I spoke to, in fact, just this, you know, this past weekend, who finally got vaccinated, but it took 4 months of continued conversations and dialogues with this person to get them convinced. And, you know, the reason why they didn't want to get vaccinated was just because they'd heard about, you know, all of these rumors, and they were terrified of getting vaccinated. And, you know, their opinion was that, well, they're young and they're healthy, why do they need the vaccine? And, but it took 4 months of conversations. And I think that's really what we're coming down to now. Those who are not vaccinated, it's going to take 10 times more effort to actually reach them. And so even with the accessibility, these are the people that have serious accessibility barriers. And so, you know, a lot more needs to be done to reach them. And it's the same with those who have the hesitancies. There is still a significant percentage of people who have hesitancies, and it could be for a variety of different reasons. You know, one of the things that I get very often right now is in pregnant people, just because, you know, in pregnancy, there's that heightened awareness of, like, not just making sure, you know, everything you're doing is safe for yourself, but it's also safe for, you know, the fetus, the baby that you're carrying. And, you know, the pregnancy is one of the areas that I've been putting a lot of effort in to try and reach people, to get them to see what the data looks like, especially because of how pregnancy puts them at a much higher risk for severe outcomes from COVID. So there's definitely people that we have to reach. It's just that the people that we still need to reach is going to take a lot more effort to get to through to them. And of course, the ones that are staunchly anti-vax, you know, I don't think anything I say is going to change their opinion. But what I'm hopeful for is that there is continued discussions and dialogue, so that we're building that vaccine confidence over the course of time. And maybe not this year, but maybe next year we might be able to convince them.
What have you seen work, especially now, for the holdouts? I know we've heard a lot recently about vaccine mandates and passports having an impact. Is that something that you're seeing in your work? And if not, what is working? What got that person off the fence after 4 months?
Yeah, so vaccine mandates, you know, play a role in the entire getting people to get vaccinated, but it's for a very specific type of person. Like, you have to understand that when it comes down to vaccine hesitancy, there's so many layers, right? And so you need these targeted efforts for each one of these layers. So mandates help those who are complacent, you know, people who are just, you know, I don't think COVID's a big deal. I'm young, you know, I'm fine. I don't really need the vaccine. I think vaccines are important, but maybe not just for me, or I don't really want to take time out of my day to go get vaccinated. So mandates would help people like that. Then they're generally in the younger age group. And we've seen this. So, you know, in BC and in Quebec, once they actually had these vaccine mandates out, we saw a dramatic increase in first doses, you know, 2 to 3 times higher than they would normally see in any given day. And they're generally people who are in the ages 12 to 29 age group. And so those who are essentially complacent, yeah, it would probably work for them. But those, you know, who have, say, for instance, distrust with healthcare systems, those who actually have these hesitancies and questions, you're not going to actually be able to change their mind based on mandates. Or if they do get vaccinated begrudgingly, you are possibly eroding vaccine confidence in the long run. So the next time they need to get vaccinated, it's going to take double the effort to get them convinced. But then in terms of those who are still hesitant, honestly, it's a matter of having that continued discussion. And having it, you know, with so much compassion and respect that, I'll be honest, is exhausting. Like, you know, for example, this one person that I just convinced, you know, it was constant conversations. We started with fertility. That was their biggest concern. Then we started talking about these adverse events that they would, you know, show, well, this person said that this happened to them. And then it would just be conversations to get them to think about things. And I'm like, well, have any of your friends gotten vaccinated? Have any of them had any, you know, side effects? Okay. Do you know anyone who's had COVID, and how has that impacted their lives? And it's really allowing them to put these pieces together and make them, you know, have a say in an informed decision for themselves, but they're actually using the right data to make that informed decision for themselves. But it does take a lot of work. These conversations that I've had with people can take upwards, you know, of an hour, and they're always one-on-one. But progress is being made, and I think that's the key part.
Well, I'm really glad there are people like you out there having those conversations that I just can't. The last thing I want to ask you about before we let you go is, we've had a conversation on a couple of episodes about global vaccine equity, and I wanted to ask you first, how is that coming along? I'm presuming still not well. And second, how would you balance the discussion we're hearing about booster shots for some of us in the fall who are at risk versus, you know, initial doses in what's got to still be like half the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so first of all, we are not doing nearly enough. Whatever we're doing is a drop in the bucket. You know, the WHO basically asked for a moratorium on booster shots up until end of September to allow countries around the world to at least get 10% of their population vaccinated. 10%. We're not even talking more than that.
Wow.
At the end of the day, when it comes to variants, we'll see more variants coming up if we are having uncontrolled spread of the virus, right? And so it really is in our own best interest to make sure that there is global vaccine equity, because it really, really impacts us as well. I mean, the whole Delta curveball that we've been thrown was because of uncontrolled spread of the virus, right? And so there's always that risk that the next variant coming is going to be able to evade the vaccines even more. And so that is really, really key and critical. When it comes down to boosters for, you know, the Canadian population, those that, you know, are either immunocompromised, so we have some data to show that those, for instance, that have solid transplant patients, we have data to show that giving a third booster, in fact, does improve their response, their immune responses. And then it's other types of either diseases or therapies that you are that, you know, for instance, B-cell depleting therapies or diseases that impact your B-cells, such as certain types of blood cancers. You know, we know that in these population that it's very hard for them to actually mount an adequate immune response. What we don't know is whether a third dose is actually going to help them mount an immune response or not. And then the second aspect of this is that, you know, we have some data from the manufacturers showing that there, you know, these are just immunogenicity studies. So just showing that, okay, your neutralizing antibodies go up after your booster shot. But we don't really know what that means in terms of actual efficacy. Does it actually increase meaningfully efficacy against symptomatic disease? We don't know. But what we do know right now is that with the two doses of the vaccine, we may see a decline in symptomatic efficacy, but we're also seeing that they still work incredibly well to prevent severe illness. So we've seen that, you know, essentially 90% plus of those who are hospitalized, who are ventilated, those who are dying are essentially those who are unvaccinated. So we know the vaccines are working incredibly well. So really what we need to be doing and focusing right now is to get the rest of the world vaccinated so that we're not going to see new variants come into play. And for all you know, over the course of time, we may actually have, you know, a booster shot that is more targeted towards a newer variant and may actually be more helpful and useful to do that. All of this to say, you know, this is for the general Canadian population. I'm not talking, you know, of those who are immunocompromised, those who are elderly, who live in congregate settings. In these situations, it actually might be prudent to give them a booster shot sooner rather than later to make sure that they are really protected as we go into our, or, you know, our fourth wave. I say as we go into a fourth wave, but we are in a fourth wave. Mm-hmm. But it would be really important to protect, you know, those who are more vulnerable to severe, you know, illness from COVID.
Sabina, thank you as always for your knowledge and your patience as we ask you all sorts of questions about vaccines.
It's my absolute pleasure.
That was Sabina Vora-Miller, and that was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Find us on Twitter, as always, at TheBigStoryFPN. Send us an email with your vaccine questions. We will have Sabina back every once in a while to answer them. You can find us at The Big Story Podcast, all one word, at rci.rogers.com. The Big Story is available in any podcast player. It is available on your smart speaker. You can just ask your device to play the Big Story podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.